Hello everyone, my name is Eric Robinson, and as you may have noticed, we just found out about 45 seconds ago we're having some formatting issues with this computer, in my slideshow. So I'm going to blame the computer and not my formatting skills on this. This might be true, we're never going to find out. But as of yesterday, I am now a middle school educator, no longer an elementary school educator based in Austin, Texas. And in addition to that, I host at the drive-in and we talk about history because somehow I stumbled into the nostalgia business. I'm still trying to figure out how that happened, but it has. And as such, I really just love history, whether it's things I'm interested in or just regional history of just any area I'm either living in or visiting. And just my love of regional history and baseball history happened combined about 8 years ago, whenever I moved to South Austin and found out that Willie Wells was from my general neighborhood, about four blocks where I was from. And so then that just sort of got me reading further and further into just not the history of South Austin, but Austin, just pre-Civil Rights era, and then also just more into the Texas Negro Leagues, Texas barnstorming, and then just leads, with Willie Wells and Negro League baseball history to the Newark Eagles. And then when I was reading about them, and then I found out that for 2 years there was a professional team in Houston that just sort of got forgotten about. And they came down here 49-50 and just sort of lost in the historical record. And it's just, I think what it is also just sort of going back to my interest in regional history. Just a little bit of the natural regional history here is just south of Harris County is Brazoria County. It's sort of known for oil refineries, Nolan Ryan, and being arguably the county with the most birds migrating to it anywhere in the continental United States. And every winter, that just the birds from the north just come down. A little bit before the raptors come down. And pretty much always around are the eagles, just there sort of soaring about. And that's pretty much a constant presence. It's sort of amazing in a fairly, apologies to anyone from Missouri, especially the Ryan family. It's just an ugly, ugly area. But these birds are beautiful. And so maybe just the people involved with the Eagles saw that and were inspired, but probably should have kept on going a little further south, because then the sand and the water in Brazoria County could have softened their fall whenever they just crash landed. And it's just an ugly scene. But I'm also glad I followed the previous presentation, because that sort of takes care of all the stuff you can't really see right there. But the Texas Negro Leagues, they were smart professional. It was really a collection of barnstorming teams, talent teams. Sometimes they would be really good, quality would dip. But what the most important aspect of the Texas Negro Leagues provided to just white ball in general was this is where the teams would come in the winter and spring for spring training. And on the way up, they would play all the talent teams and essentially use them as scouting trips. That's like so many great players from Biz Mackey to Willie Wells to, that would be three presentations worth of stuff just discussing that were discovered just by the teams going north from Houston and San Antonio working their way up. And just to give you an idea of this talent, prior to the 2006 special committee, of the 18 Negro League players elected into the Hall of Fame, 5 of the 18 were from the Central Texas area. So that's, 28-29%, something like that. And then, after the 2006 Special Committee, that added another 3 Native Texans from the Negro Leagues that, were from the Texas area. So a little bit of the Newark Eagles, one of the legendary franchises. And they were formed in 1935 as the Brooklyn Eagles. The following year, just across the river, went to New Jersey. They were the 1946 Negro World Series champions against the Kansas City Monarchs in so symbolic, 1946 Negro League World Series champions. And while they had a great run, that was their only World Series championship. And Max Manning, their star pitcher during the 40s, he described them, and I've seen a lot of other you know, descriptions of the eagles that said this, but not quite as concise as they were to Black and White what the Dodgers were to Brooklyn. And they were just a big, thriving social scene. Celebrities, big names from the Black community, that was the place to be seen for roughly 10 years. And a big main reason of that was Effa Manley. Her husband, A. Manley, who somehow became rich for reasons that really aren't discussed or talked about. They seem to be gambling, but it probably is, and then it's just left vague, and he doesn't talk about his personal history too often. He was one who formed the team, big baseball fan, and as Effa would say in later interviews, after about 2 years of just being the owner, running the team, he sort of asked her if she wanted to, and she was yes. So her official title was business manager, and she is such an interesting character. Like, I don't know y'all's backgrounds here, but if any of y'all are Hollywood movie producers or whatever and need an idea for the next awesome period piece baseball movie, Effa Manley. She had a white mom, was raised by a Black man that she called her dad. Come to find out, she learned as a teenager that she was actually had, her biological father was white. So she was a white woman with dark enough olive skin where she passed as Black and lived her entire life in the Black community. And they say about the only times she would sort of dip out of that is if she was traveling alone or for other reasons and needed just the access that being white would get her. And she was part of that 2006 special committee, and is now the only woman in the Negro, or not, excuse me, the only woman in the Hall of Fame, period. And her story is just fascinating. Again, worth 3, 4, 5 presentations, 120-minute movie. Producers, if any of you look into it. And just of the Eagles, of you know, players from the New York Eagles of note, Larry Doby, Monty Irvin, Don Newcomb, Biz Mackey, Leon Day, Max Manning, the million-dollar infield of Neil Seibels, Dick Sadie, Willie Wells, and Ray Dandridge. And, you know, of course, I just sort of had to throw in Willie Wells' picture and my favorite one of him. And, but yes. And then 1947 happens, and things change. And it wasn't just Jackie Robinson, you know, like how the public tends to remember. It was also Larry Doby, Hank Thompson, Dan Bakehead, and Willard Brown that same year as well. And then the minor leagues were filling up, and they were just losing their players, and then just losing the public's attention, you know, from the Negro audience. And it hit New York about as hard as anywhere, because in 1948, just 2 years after the world champion, where they had an attendance of around 120,000, in 2 years that dropped to 35,000 in 1948. That's what, 27% of their attendance just 2 years prior. What really, besides just I believe Don Newcomb and Larry Doby, essentially the same team, aside from just normal turnover. And heavy financial losses. Like, the Manleys, while they did have money to own and operate their team, they weren't an extremely wealthy family. You know, the offices were out of their home in suburban New Jersey, in that area. And so they just could not sustain those losses, and they just were losing their best players on top of those financial losses, making it harder for them to even compete in the Northeast, and just nothing to bank on. And then on top of that, Manley, this is her passion. This is what she loves. And she's losing it. And she started making some comments that when you read them in like present day terms, almost make it sound like she's pro-segregation, you know, pro baseball not integrating and just keeping the Black players only playing for Black teams. And it's sort of uncomfortable reading it now. And years later, you sort of realize she sort of backed out from it, and you realize just the bitterness that came from. She's losing her passion. And so by 1948, they had to sell the team. And it was in early December, and they sold it for $15,000. They had lost $100,000 in recent years They were just trying to cover the recent expenses and get them gone. They sent to a group in Memphis of Dr. Dennis William H. Young and Dr. B.B. Martin. And Dr. Martin, his brother, was the owner of the Memphis Red Sox and also the Negro American League president. So they got everything. They got the players, they got the contracts, got the uniforms, got the bus. And an interesting clause, because one of the things Ethan Manley really fought for is Ethan Manley, though, still got to keep, if they sold any player to the major leagues, she would have to keep half of their sale price. And an interesting thing happened during that trip, specifically while she was in the air from selling the team to back to New Jersey, that I'll get to in a little bit. So the group out of Memphis, you know, they were looking at Nashville a little bit, but why did they come to Houston? Like, why did they decide on Houston? A lot of people in the Negro Leagues at the time thought the Deep South might be their chances of survival. That's where, you know, they're further away from just the teams in the Northeast, further away from Jackie Robinson, further away from that attention. It was still more racially segregated, so they thought just the fact that, you know, the cities themselves weren't as integrated, it would might grow within the black community a little more. They had 80,000 African Americans in the city according to the 1950 census, one of the largest populations. I believe the largest in the Deep South and one of the largest in the nation at the time. They had a fairly strong history with the Houston Black Buffaloes, been fairly successful. Like I said, real popular place for spring training and barnstorming games. Some of these barnstorming games would have attendance in the thousands, well into the thousands, depending on who was playing and what the event was. It hosted the 1945 Negro League All-Star Game, which was a successful event, went over well. And it was a new market. It was someplace new, and there was no professional presence whatsoever. So they just felt that Houston had all these qualifications that would make it work. And the Houston Informer was the African-American weekly newspaper, and it's an amazing newspaper. And I got to spend some time going through the archives, and I would just keep getting distracted about, like, I want to find out, like, with the man dressed like a woman who committed these murders in the first court, did he get convicted? You know, and then it was 30 minutes of research of that. He did. And then I got to go back to the sports page. But the Informer, they were so excited for professional baseball. Covered it. That was two-thirds of their sports page besides the local things they had to cover. You know, writers just calling for a professional team, just wanting this professional baseball. And the teams they really covered were the Indianapolis Clowns. They just loved the zany barnstorming antics, the costumes, the having fun. Satchel Paige, pretty much anything Satchel Paige did got mentioned. You know, like, he goes on a really neat vacation in Florida and catches a really big fish. It's in the Houston Informer. And the Kansas City Monarchs. And the Kansas City Monarchs, that was the team they held in regard. You know, they just really respected them. Clowns for funny game. Satchel Paige because he's an interesting character. Kansas City Monarchs, you know, like, you don't say anything bad about them. Okay? And they're so excited about it. In 1948, they called Larry Doby our generation's favorite. Larry Doby. He does not get enough credit. That was the season he had 14 home runs in 121 games. But they were just that excited about black baseball. And this just sort of says a great quote that sort of sums it up. The city has the greatest Negro population in the South, and there should be someone with the power and experience to organize a great team. And they said the failure in the past was just the financial matters and just poor organization. So, in the offseason, 1948, Dr. Sheldon Martin decided to move to Houston. Thought things were looking good. But, well, other teams besides the Newark Eagles are having problems. The New York Black Yankees, they closed down. The Homestead Braves, they dropped down to just a barnstorming team. It was essentially the same team in name only. So, the two leagues consolidated and to establish the new Negro American. Monty Irvin, when Ethan Manley was on the plane back from Tennessee to New Jersey, Branch Rickey brought this contract because he thought the Eagles was off. So there was a several week long legal fight, set a precedent where then the white teams had to buy out the contracts. And so when Ethan Ellen gets the money, she, half of it goes to her lawyer, and of that half that remains, she keeps half, and in that half, the other half goes to the new owners of the Houston Eagles. Notice which name got left out whenever she did that. Monty Irvin. So that angered quite a few people. And then, whenever the move, there's some of their star players, Leon Day, Ray Dandridge, and Max Manning, just didn't want to go to the South. Max Manning, he did come back later in the season, but with Monty Irvin, Leon Day, and Ray Dandridge, in less than a week, they lost 3 Hall of Fame players. Can you think of another team? I couldn't think of another team that's lost 3 Hall of Fame players in 1 week. Okay, so in the 1949 season, it just went bad. You know, that's just really all you need to know. 3 managers, 1 season, finished last. The Houston Informer went from being really excited to critical, and the Houston fans just stayed away. They didn't know the players. They didn't know if they were pro or not. The team was just playing bad, so it really wasn't attracting people who were just baseball fans. You know, they had men's league teams and softball teams. And the attention was now on the majors, where even down here in Houston, they're more excited about reading about Cleveland Indians, Brooklyn Dodgers, New York Giants, than just the team down the street. So in 1950, horrible, horrible financial shape. But they're feeling upbeat. They did make some, you know, good signings that they thought would help, but the attendance declined even further. More road games, and throughout the year, a lot of their home games were home games in Houston, but played wherever they could think it would might work. Started doing more weekend games, more games in Galveston, and it just did not work. There was even one period in the Houston Informer in 1950 where they went approximately a month where they were not mentioned at all in the newspaper. However, the men's league softball team was front page news. The Houston Cotton Clubbers won that year. And one of my new favorite team names, after the Atlanta Black Crackers. So in August, they just sort of ended up gradually moving to Nashville to finish out the season. Following year, they moved to New Orleans and disbanded. And the final record that year, 23-41-1. So why did it not work in Houston? And because it has some unique reasons why it didn't work in Houston other than just attention going to Major League Baseball like it was in other places, like why it had to leave Newark, why, you know, Homestead Grays closed. And a lot of it was just, what if a pro team comes to town and no one cares? They just showed up and the interest was just not there. And they wanted players and teams they knew. Even if it was just like there was a lot of confusion of whether they were just another Texas semi-pro team, and a lot of having to be convinced that, these are professionals. And then he already thought of himself as a major league town. And so the legacy, several players sold to the majors during that time. This could be a symbolic end of the Negro Leagues. I've seen some people say that, people argue that. I don't. You know, it showed that Black America had turned to America or to the Major League Baseball. And then, if you look at the, then in 2014 in May here in Houston, the Civil Rights game, it was between the Astros and the Orioles, and the Astros dressed as the Houston Eagles, and there was 38,400 plus at the game. And I would just imagine there was more people watching the Astros in that Eagles uniform that one game than in nearly 2 seasons of the Houston Eagles wearing that uniform when they actually played here. And really, that's it. That's my sources. I think some of you might see your name up there. So there we go. And yes, if there's any questions.
I wanted to know after the Eagles came to Houston, did they entirely play against other Negro League teams? Or because of the distance, I'm assuming Houston was relatively far from where most of the other teams had their homes. Did they play a split schedule, or how did that work?
There would be some barnstorming and exhibition games, but like the Cleveland Buckeyes had moved to Kentucky. Memphis Red Sox, I believe they played games against Birmingham, so the league itself had sort of moved south as well.
I'm from Rhode Island, and there's a professor, Robert Savoniak, from Rhode Island College, and he's written a lot about Effa Manley. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the reasons that she was upset was she didn't, I don't know if you talked about a couple minutes, she didn't get much. Early on, she didn't get anything for her players, mm-hmm. and she got some for her players, and that's why she was upset, because, as you probably know, they were a big, the Negro League teams, they were a big part of the economy mm-hmm. in that part of town, and so that's one of the reasons that she might have, that's what his inference was. I think he spoke at a Jerry Malloy conference, so
That's totally right, and really what I had to work on with this is not to turn it into an Effa Manley presentation. I did want to address that a little more, like if I, you know, do something further with this, right. But just for the presentation to focus, I have another one.
In 1935, they called the Brooklyn Eagles. That was the newspaper of Brooklyn. Did they sponsor them?
There was a previous team called the Eagles. I don't know if they were related to the newspaper or not, but Abe Manley sort of bought the name from the previous owner and almost sort of brought the franchise slot in the name, and they were vaguely connected, but not really. And All right. Well, thank you very much.